Episode 2323, My Strength is My Story with Dr. John DeMartini, The Values Factor.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at
a stop sign. Happy, happy day. Today is my favorite day of the week. It is my Strength is My Story series. And today we have a doctor in the house, Dr. John DeMartini. Oh, yes. Have you ever wondered why you value what you value? Why you lead your life and why you make the decisions that you do? Well, we're diving deep. For those of you who are brand new to Create Your Now, friends and family of Dr. DeMartini, welcome to our family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already didn't have the opportunity, you want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the KISSES newsletter, the Keep It Simple strategy, everyday solutions to live, love, and impact. Well, I hope you are ready to be blessed because this man has a wealth of knowledge. And the time that we speak together and share conversation, it just rocked my brain. It rocked my world. And I thought, oh, that explains something. We go very deep about values. We highlight things all the way from speed reading to Mars. Yes, we cover it on Earth and outer space. So I want you to enjoy this. I want you to take notes. This is something you want to come back to. So without further ado, let's welcome in the Dr. John DeMartini, The Values Factor. Hello and welcome to Create You Now. I am so excited. We have a doctor in the house and that means I have to be on extra good behavior and he knows a lot of words. He's written a lot of books. His name is Dr. John DeMartini. He's a world-renowned specialist in human behavior and personal development, a researcher, and a global educator. He is the founder of the DeMartini Institute, a private research and education organization which hosts a curriculum of more than 72 courses. Dr. DeMartini has studied over 30,000 books. You got it, 30,000 books across all academic disciplines and has synthesized the wisdom of the ages, which he shares on stage and online in over 100 countries. He is a best-selling author of 40 books published in 29 languages. Oh my goodness, those are a lot of numbers. You better get your readers on. Welcome, my friend. How are you, Dr. DeMartini?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it is my pleasure and truly an honor. I have read one of many books. I still have a lot more left to go. I've got a couple on order, but The Values Factor, The Secret to Creating an Inspired and Fulfilling Life, is one that I just have been eating up. I love it. Absolutely love it.
So you got all the tabs on there.
I do. Speaking of tabs, how do you read your books? How do you keep track of all your notes?
You know, there's many different ways. Sometimes I speed read them and I underline and make little codes and hand them to a person to type the codes up and put them in, sort them and put them in my system. Sometimes if it's just a few, I go right into particular places that I have in my computer for where all my quotes go and ideas go. I have it very organized. So, and sometimes I'll just speed read the book and I won't even do anything with it. I'll just take it in.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. Is one of those 72 courses a speed reading course?
Believe it or not, there is. I've been teaching a speed reading course since 1975 or six.
Wow. Well, I may need to brush up because I haven't even hit 30,000 books. I might get a couple, 2 to 3, maybe 4 books a week. And that's a lot. I mean, I've got a basketball team. I'm a mom of 5. So, you know, my life is kind of a little bit of a juggling act.
Well, if you're doing that, that's exceptional because that's more than the average person.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, we got to dive in because I know you are a busy man and I want to honor your time. But I have to ask you first, what brings you joy?
What inspires me most, and it's been doing it for 48 years, is learning anything I can about human behavior to help people maximize their awareness and potential, do something extraordinary with their lives, and get to share that with people. I love that. I do it every day, 7 days a week, pretty well.
That is incredible. A lot of people still are kind of in search, like, what do I want to be when I grow up? How did you come to really find that true love for you?
Well, maybe I haven't grown up. Maybe that's the issue. I was 17 years old. I had just almost died. And I had the opportunity to meet a gentleman named Paul C. Bragg at a recreation hall on the north shore of Oahu, Hawaii, at Sunset Recreation Hall. And 1 hour, this one man with a message inspired me to make me believe that I could overcome my learning problems, because I had learning problems as a child. I didn't read till I was 18. So I had dropped out of school and was a street kid and was living in a tent at the time. And so I got so inspired by this man because I thought that night that maybe I could overcome my learning problems and maybe I could someday become intelligent. I never thought I would ever going to be able to do that. So I used to have people read to me, but I never read. And that night my life turned and it shifted priorities. I was riding big waves and being a surfer and probably with a death wish riding giant waves. But I had a shift and I decided I wanted to learn how to read, and I started to try to tackle that. With the help of my mother and a dictionary, we would practice speaking properly, the meaning, the words, the spelling, and the application in a sentence of 30 words a day until my vocabulary strong enough where I was able to go back to school and finish. I had took a GED to go back to school, a general education degree, and with the help of my mom, I learned how to read, and then I never stopped.
Oh my goodness. Well, obviously not. You've read over 30,000. Well, it's got to be over that because today is a new day, so you've probably already read two or three today.
Well, I can't say every day I do that because some days it's a lot online. But anytime I knock out around 250 pages of research online, I classify it as research equivalent of a book today. Today, I actually was going through a Greek philosopher, Xenophon, who, you know, was a mercenary individual, but he had some great quotes on leadership. So I was studying his writings, and I'm impressed. It's a very ancient book, but I'm going through it, and it's beautifully written.
Well, I can only imagine all of the different wordsmithing that you've been able to do over your lifetime. There are a lot of different ways to really construct our lives. You construct people's lives by actually sharing and speaking with them. You have courses. What do you see that directs them in their thoughts, their actions, and even their decisions and shapes their lives?
Well, you said a beautiful question there, because in all the years of study and all the disciplines that I've been blessed to go through, one stands out above all the rest, and it's a study called axiology. And axiology is a study of value and worth. And every human being, regardless of gender, age, or culture, lives by a set of priorities, a set of values, things that are most to least important in their individual life at that moment. And that set of values is evolving and tweaking through life. But at any moment, that set of values is what they're filtering their perceptions through, making decisions, and taking actions accordingly. We literally have areas in our brain that filter our reality according to the values. So our values really underline how we perceive, decide, and act, and therefore dictate our destiny. So tell me what your values are and tell you where you're headed. My highest value is teaching. Second is learning. So I'm headed in that direction.
Well, and it makes sense, teaching and learning. However, though, before we get too far into values, because I think some people would Google, thank you, Google, for all the craziness that it gives us. And it would outline values, but it would use different words than how you might say it. So define values for us.
Well, really, it's when you go and buy something in a store, economics is derived from axiology. So if you look in the store, if you're willing to pay for something, you value it. It has a value and you can quantify it. Alfred Marshall in his Principles of Economics, which is a classic book, showed that you can measure every single perception and movement in a human being. I can make you stop moving by paying you enough or start moving by paying you enough to make you do something or not do something if I get the right price. So you can quantitatively measure the motive of action by the value that you have and quantify it by economic value. So the really the what makes people decide something's valuable or not is if it fulfills something they perceive is missing in their life. Our voids, as Aristotle said, determine our values. And so if we perceive we don't have money, we search for money. If we don't have relationship, we search for relationship. If we don't have friends, we search for friends. Whatever we perceive is most missing becomes most important. So identifying what those missingnesses are and what those importances are, the reason we call it important is because we want to import it into our sphere of awareness and our sphere of influence. We want to import it and bring it into our life.
Oh, that's incredible. And when you really think about that, it makes sense. I think about my children and how I have values, but each of our children have their own values. We all have our own values.
Totally different values. They're fingerprint specific. There's no two people the same.
Yeah, which amazes me, and because I'm a people watcher. I mean, I just got to be honest. I can go and sit. Remember the days of the mall where you could sit down and you would people watch and you could just observe and, you know, the actions and almost can sit there and figure out their decisions before they even make the decision of what they're going to do next. The values are definitely leading that. But on the flip side, right, we all have our own values. However, though, we also can be leading and living our lives by someone else's values. Well, what does that look like?
The moment we meet somebody in a mall, since you picked a mall, and you perceive somebody that you think is more intelligent than you, more achieving and successful than you, more wealthy than you, more stable in relationship than you, more socially connected and influential than you, more physically fit or attractive than you, and more spiritually aware than you. The moment you compare yourself to them and put them up and assume and exaggerate their position, you'll minimize yourself in turn, and because of comparison. So anytime we see somebody and we put them on a pedestal and minimize ourselves into a pit, we are too humble to admit what we see in them inside ourselves. And we will tend to brain offload decisions and actions and inject their values into our life and give away what's most important to us to sacrifice to fit in and conform to their ideals. If you think about it, most likely somewhere in your life, you dated some guy and you were enamored and infatuated, maybe with one guy at least. I'm sure you probably had to go through it. You had this real infatuation and they were into a particular thing and you weren't necessarily into it, but you were interested in them. And so you sacrificed what was really important in your life at that time to be with them for fear of loss of them. And so you morphed, you might say, and created a dysmorphic idea of yourself to fit into their life until eventually hedonic adaptation makes you adapt and lose some of that infatuation over time. And then you say, you know what, I want my life back. And you go back to what's priority to you. But anytime you infatuate with somebody or put them on a pedestal, you will tend to inculcate some of their values into your life and cloud the clarity of what you're committed to. And this is where many people live. They live clouded and unclear and not listening to the inner voice and vision within and using that to inspire and catalyze greatness out of their life. They're deluding themselves and being second at being somebody else instead of first being who they are.
Ooh, that's good. That's what we got to chew on. You know, I mean, if you think about it, that are we really giving and serving ourselves best by being second to someone that we love? Which brings up relationships. You know, we think about values. How do values shape our relationships, especially a committed relationship like marriage?
Well, I'm going to say something that's probably shocking somebody. Even though we have the fantasy that we're committed to the individual in the marriage, we're really committed to the fulfillment of our highest values. And as long as that individual seemingly is going to help us fulfill our highest values, we endure them. But if they do enough stuff that challenges what we stand for and what's really valuable to us, we start questioning the relationship. And no matter how committed you are, that can be very challenging at times. I had a lady that said, well, I'm committed to my husband. I said, well, if he came home and you found out he gambled away all the money and he was had a sexually transmitted disease and went off and had another woman, and he ended up starting aggressively fighting with you and drinking and stopped working, how committed are you? She says, I've been out the door on the third thing you mentioned. So we like to have the ideal that we're committed no matter what. And some people are, because they have a value on either a religious idea, what's going to happen if they do that, or social influence if they do that, or the martyring they get out of that. And sometimes because they just go, I still get enough benefit out of this individual. But nobody's going to stay in a relationship unless they perceive there's still more advantage in their value system than disadvantage. They'll do it. So the wisest thing I found in relationships is to identify what's really, 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 truly most important to the individual you're in relationship with. And find out what their highest value is, because that's their identity revolve around. My identity revolves around the highest value, which is teaching. Yours may be mothering and bringing messages out to the world. But whatever is highest on your value, your identity revolves around it. Your ontology, your essence of being is that. Finding out what that is and asking, how specifically is what they're dedicated to, what their highest value is, what they're inspired by, what means so much to them, how is it helping me fulfill what's highest on mine? If you can't answer that, you're almost guaranteed to be narcissistically projecting your values onto them and trying to get them to live in your values. And that doesn't work. Anytime you try to project onto others your values, you have futility. Anytime you try to inject theirs and try to live in their values, you have futility. So learning how to see how what they're committed to is helping you find what, help you fulfill what you're committed to. And then back, how is what you're committed to help them find it? And answer those questions. It's a great dinner question, you know, because if you can sit there and ask, how is what you're totally dedicated to, raising a family, for instance, or raising beautiful children or something, or bringing a message of inspiration to people? How is it helping me in my values, which is running a business or making an income? If I can't see it, I'm going to constantly project onto you and want to fix you. And I'm going to have a fantasy you're going to someday be in my values. And then I'm going to punish you until you do that. And I'm not going to tell you what it is you're supposed to know. That's the guess. And this is what a lot of people do in their relationships. But caring enough about the other individual to not put them down in the pit or put them on a pedestal, but put them in your heart by respecting what their values are and seeing how it serves you so you can appreciate them for who they are. When you do, they turn into who you love.
Wow, I love what you said, not putting them on a pedestal or putting them in a pit, but putting them in your heart. Man, that's a hard one, really. I mean, when you think about it, even somebody you don't know, a stranger, and you're walking by them, we are very judgmental creatures and can be. And we choose at that immediate second whether or not we're going to put that stranger on a pedestal, in the pit, or wait, maybe I see them differently and put them in my heart.
Well, the reason why we put them in a pedestal or a pit when we meet somebody we don't know is very simple. We have stored in our subconscious mind all of the wounds of the past and all the fantasies of the past and all of the associations in our brain, sight, smell, taste, feel, and all those things that we've associated with those painful people or those pleasurable people. If this person has any resemblances, any associations or remind us, we immediately go, wow, or oh, stay away. Whoa, wow, or whoa, because of our stuff. It has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with our stuff. What I learned, I went through an Oxford dictionary. You'll probably think this is neurotic, but that's what a human behavioral specialist does. I went through an Oxford dictionary primarily because I noticed that a lot of the things I was judging in other people were things I was judging in myself. So I went through the Oxford dictionary and circled every possible human behavioral trait that I could find. And I found 4,628 of them because I wrote them all out. And I circled or underlined them. And I put the name that I could think of in my life that I'd met that displayed that trait to the most extreme. Just my own initialing out there. And then I thought, okay, John, go to a moment where and when you perceived yourself displaying or demonstrating that same or similar behavior to somebody. And where was it? When was it? Who did I do it to, and who perceived me that way? And I went through there methodically, slowly but surely. And this is going to shock people. I found every single trait that I found in that book in me. I was kind at times, cruel at times, nice, mean, honest, dishonest, considered, inconsiderate, arrogant, humble. I had every one of the traits I saw in human behavior. And then I realized trying to get rid of half of yourself to love yourself isn't going to work. learning how to love all those parts. And that's why the only time we react to people around us is when we're too proud or too humble to admit what we see in them inside ourselves. So I would rather preemptively strike and go find out where I have it. So when I meet people, I don't have to react and have them cause me to seek or avoid them. I just automatically see the presence of them, and I realize that they're a reflection of me. Makes a difference. That helps relationships big time.
Oh, huge. I mean, significantly. Because also, I mean, you think about relationships. You think about anything. The only thing we can control is ourselves. I can't control you. I mean, I could try, but I think you have enough words over the top of me. I mean, if you read the Oxford Dictionary, I'm so not going to try to challenge you at all. But, you know, I could try to control you, but there's not a way. Maybe money, I guess, if it's a high value, I could. But otherwise, it's just us. We control our own individual selves. And really, when you think about it, we're doing a disservice to our other human beings that are out there and the creations that they are, of not allowing them to be present in their own presence and being able to live within their own values.
So I was asked, not this last year, 2020, but 2019, around October, to meet with five Israeli leaders and three Palestinian leaders. And they asked me to mediate a conflict they were having. And so when I first get there in the morning in this beautiful hotel that we were meeting at, this one woman, Israeli leader, said, "Dr. DeMartini, do you believe in absolute evil?" And I said, "No." And she goes, "Well, I do." And so I said to her, I said, "Do you think that has had some impact on your negotiation outcomes?" She didn't say anything. And the negotiator, mediator, was sitting there and just kind of chuckled. And I said, "Okay, what do you perceive to be absolute evil?" And she was very black and white, very amygdala-based thinking, not broad-minded to it. And I said, "What do you think is this absolute evil?" She says, "Intolerance." And I was going, "Have you looked in the mirror, babe?
Have you seen this reflection?"
"Have you seen the reflection?" And I thought, okay, but this is not uncommon. So I said, "Intolerance." "Okay. So can you think of some individual that represents intolerance?" I just threw that at her. She says, "Yes, I do." And now this individual she's talking about is sitting 5 feet away on the opposite side of a table. She's really charged against this guy. Of course, he is charged against her because they're rivals. Of course, they need each other in order to become famous. Without the other person, there's no fame. Right. So I said, "So I got a question for you. I want you to right now think that that's the trait you dislike in this individual. And you think it's absolute evil. I'd like you to go for a moment into your life and look at where you've been intolerant. Because it's easy to go and judge somebody, but before we judge somebody, it's wiser to look at ourselves and make sure we're not doing that. Because if we're doing that and we're feeling guilty about it, we'll project it onto them and resent them, thinking that it's about them when it's actually just bringing up our own wounds, our own judgments." I said, "So go to a moment where you've been intolerant." "Oh, I pride myself on never being intolerant. I would never do that. I'm very tolerant. Everybody I know thinks I'm intolerant." And I'm going, "Okay." And so I decided I'm going to humble myself. And I started listing all of my intolerances. I get intolerant sometimes when I'm waiting in line. I get intolerant when I'm waiting at the doctor's office. I get intolerant when I'm waiting for an airline when it's delayed. I get intolerant when it takes long to get the food on the plane. I just started listing all the places where I'm intolerant in relationships, kids, social, waiting in line. Anywhere I could think, I just started listing them out. And she started thinking, "Well, okay, I have some intolerances there." And I started her on a journey of exploring and reflecting and introspecting her intolerances. I made her think of 39 examples of where she was doing it until the quantity of her intolerance was equal to this man's. And she actually got teary-eyed and she got humbled for a second. And I said, "Do you now own that trait? Because any trait you don't own that you're too proud to admit you have, you're going to resent in other people. And that's going to block your negotiation capacities. And you're going to end up being intolerant." And she just sat there quiet. And then I said, "Now, now that you've owned that trait, which is very respectful that you did that, I said, now go to the moment, go to an actual moment where and when you perceive this individual that you think is so intolerant, that you think is absolutely evil. Go to a moment when they actually displayed it and ask, how did it serve you? What was the benefit to your life of them displaying it in that moment? Well, there is no benefit. I don't know. No, everything has two sides. What's the upside to it? I can't see anything. You stopped before you even looked. You said, I can't see anything. You didn't even take the time to look. I watched your eyes. You just stared at me in defiance instead of look. Let's look really truthfully. And I started listing examples of what it might be, why intolerance has value. It can raise the standard. If you're expecting a certain standard in your work, being intolerant of anything less could be valuable. And I started giving her ideas of where intolerance has a place in human behavior. And she started rolling, and I did 32 examples, took an hour, 32 examples of where his intolerance served her. And the one that was biggest was before his actions that were intolerant. She was an ordinary family mother that was not really involved in politics, but an intolerant action got her engaged and got her involved and started her researching. She became knowledgeable. She started speaking out. She became a leader. She ended up writing a book. She became noted for her field, started meeting famous people. And where she is today is a leader in the world. And if it wasn't for that intolerance of that individual, where would she be? And she got humbled. And I said, now the question is, are you really committed to leadership? Are you following the angry mob for your own fame? Because if you're really committed to leadership, you're going to do a mediation and teach them how to love. But if you're going to be into anger, you're just supporting a group of people that are biased with a subjective bias and stopping it and using the hypocrisy that you're trying to do this for peace. But what peace is in your mind is getting other people to live in what you think is important. And that doesn't lead to that. And I got her humbled for a second and she stopped. I said, so let's look at the benefits of your life and where you would be without this man. And she cried. She really cried. And there was crying all over the room. Everybody was sitting there deeply reflecting on what it is. And even the man was crying. And I said, I think this is a good stopping point. We're going to take a little potty break. And the man came up to me and he says, you know, Dr. DeMartini, wow. What I learned from that one little session right there was mind blowing. I was really angry with this woman. And I could swear she was talking about me. And I said, she was. He goes, I had the same feeling of her, but right now I'm not angry at her because I was doing what you said. I started owning the traits that I saw in them and reflecting and finding how it served. And I never took the time in my entire life to ever look at the upsides. I just assumed all black and white. This is bad. I said, but really, I think you just got us on the table where we can talk now. I said, well, that's my job. That's what I'm here for. I said, we just took one little trait. Imagine if we made a list of all the traits we're judging in each other and took the time to own them, find the upsides to them, find out the downsides if they were not that way and the opposite. Because sometimes we're upset with a trait because we assume the opposite is some fantasy that we have. But when we actually get to see that everything, if it's here on the planet and it hasn't gone extinct, it must be here for a reason. It serves. There's a higher purpose for it. Our job is to discover it and to liberate ourselves from the, you might say, the amygdala and animal survival mechanisms of black and white thinking and get into a place where we can see things with meaning. And he was very impacted like that. And that lady was wise enough. When I came back 3 months later to Johannesburg to meet with her again, she asked me on her radio show. And then she shared to the audience, about 2 million people, how she had to humble herself. And if we really want to make a difference and make progress, we have to humble ourselves. And I said to her, I got tears in my eyes. I said, now I see the leader.
Oh, that gives me goosebumps. I mean, just, it's amazing what we do when we give up what we need to, as in, hey, you have to meet my values, because you can't be a well-rounded individual if you're not taking in those 4,628, you said, ones that you circled in the Oxford Dictionary, I think was the number. We have to own them So then we can move forward from them and know that, yeah, we don't have to stick with them, but we also know that we're not perfect.
Well, the perfection, I'd like to address that, because we often get caught in moral hypocrisies. And we think that perfection is one-sidedness. But actually, the perfection is both sides. Because there's time to be both sides. I think it was in the biblical writings, Ecclesiastes 3. There's a time for sowing, a time for reaping, a time for peace, a time for war, a time for rending, etc. And there's time for everything under the sun. And sometimes I think that wisdom is oversighted for our own amygdala survival thinking. I went up to this lady one time and I said, to make a point, I said, if I was to come up to you and I was to say to you that you're always positive, never negative, always kind, never cruel, always nice, never mean, always peaceful, never wrathful, always giving, never taking, always generous, never stingy, always considerate, never inconsiderate, would you believe me?
Probably.
And she's going, no, she goes, no.
Oh, no.
Because she's thinking of times when she's yelled at her husband, wanted to slap her kids, think, you know, all the basic stuff that's called life. And she's thinking of that. And I said, can you see that your intuition and your little internal psychometer inside was whispering to you on the other side of what I just said? She goes, yeah. I said, if I was to come to you and I said, you're always mean, you're never nice, you're always cruel, you're never kind, you're always negative, never positive, always peaceful, never wrathful, always inconsiderate, never considerate, always stingy, never generous, etc. Would you believe me? She goes, nope, because I immediately think of the times when I've been kind and generous and giving. And I said, but if I came to you and I said, sometimes you're nice, sometimes you're mean, sometimes you're kind, sometimes you're cruel, sometimes you're positive, sometimes you're negative, sometimes you're generous, sometimes you're stingy. Would you believe me now? And she said, yep. I said, we only have certainty about ourselves when we can see ourselves objectively. And we live with uncertainty and defiant defense when we're trying to hide a part of ourselves from ourselves. And so it's such a lesson to finally realize that we're the hero and the villain. It's not on the outside of us. And they're just reminding us of the parts we haven't loved within us. And now giving us an opportunity to go probing deeper into that and discover the magnificence of that. Because when you look, if you were to videotape yourself 24 hours a day for a 3-month period, and I had the right to edit what I saw 24 hours a day, I could make you a hero or a villain or a saint or a sinner or a virtue or a vice. I could take a CNN or a Fox News view.
Exactly.
And so what happens is I learned that I don't need to get rid of any part of myself, and I don't need to go and try to add something to myself. I always say at the level of the soul, nothing's missing in us, because the soul is the state of unconditional love. At the level of the soul, nothing's missing in us. But at the level of our senses, which we filter reality through biases, we think there are things missing. When we finally realize nothing's missing in us and the people around us, it's invigorating and liberating, and it helps us open our heart to people. Because anytime we're too proud or too humble to admit what we see in them is inside us, we go into narcissism or altruism, and we try to sacrifice them or ourselves in order to have a relationship. And it doesn't. It's futility, and it doesn't last.
Well, and you know, we're wearing a mask most of the time. It's like, yeah, a masquerade ball every single day. It's like, where am I going to dress up and who am I going to be today?
Well, that has a place. When my wife was alive, she passed away many years ago, 17 years almost. But when she was alive, she had, I think, 31 wigs. And she said, I'm going to keep you from ever having an affair by having an affair every night with some other woman. I never knew what she was doing. I never had an affair, but I thought that was brilliant. So I'd come home with an older woman with gray hair one minute, then a sexy redhead, and then a brunette. And she would put on, she liked to act, so she'd put on a new facade. And it was just fabulous. I never knew what I was going to get.
Well, that's fabulous for you, for sure. And you're right. There is a time and a place for that, just like you were actually referencing Ecclesiastes. With that, and going into that a little bit deeper, in life, change is a constant. And so if change is a constant, I'm going to make an assumption that our values can change too.
Yes.
Is that true? And how do they change?
Well, when you're 0 to 10 years old, you probably want to play. Probably because of all the repression of the parents, and you want to escape the parents' repressions. But by the time you're, 10 to 20, you probably want to socialize. Because you're getting puberty and you're going to want to get out and socialize. When you're 20 to 30, you're probably going to want to find a relationship and maybe some sort of career. When you're 30 to 40, you're probably going to want to start a family and, build your own business. Each decade, there are slight variations that are stages or phases of life that we have different values. And, that's inevitable. So the hierarchy of your values is changing. And whatever it is, you're filtering your reality accordingly. If a mother's 35 and she's got 3 children under the age of 5 and she walks in a mall, you can almost guarantee if her highest values are children, she's going to spot children's clothes, children's entertainment, children's education, children's health, children's stuff. Her husband, who's probably going to be focused on work in that case to pay for that, he's going to see a computer, he's going to see a suit, he's going to see briefcases, he's going to see whatever it takes, what company's busy to buy stock in. He's going to do whatever he can to figure out how to get ahead business-wise and financial-wise. So he's going to see a different world out there. No two people see the same world. Science knows that. It's all a hallucination of our own values filtering reality. So yeah, but as it's changing, so do our realities change. And we're constantly having to readjust the values of the person we care about, whether it's our children or our spouse or the people at work. Everybody's changing. What happens if you've got an employee and all of a sudden they find out they're pregnant and now their values, estrogen starts going up and they now think, I've got to think of kids. And they're now not as focused at work. That's understandable. Their values are changed. Or all of a sudden you just found out that somebody that you just were married to, they passed away. And all of a sudden you're now a widow or something. And now you're going, wait a minute, my values are changed. What's important to me now? I met a lady that her husband and son was killed in the tsunami in Phuket back in 2004. And both her husband and son, boom, gone. And she never even remotely thought of dating a younger man until then. So she went out and got her hair changed color and did this and did that. And I thought, well, this is interesting. She's loud like about a 35-year-old woman, but she's actually close to 60. And I thought that was a shift in values. And we have gradual shifts, tweaks, and we also have cataclysmic events that can shift it big time. So yeah, we can have changes in values and change our life's pathway. I always say the life's journey is a summation of all the destinies. And the destinies are all the destinations that your values are taking you to until they change.
Ooh, that's good stuff. Well, I know if anybody's wanting more of this, you can definitely pick up his book, The Values Factor, The Secret to Creating an Inspired and Fulfilling Life. And we'll be sure to have more information in the show notes where you can follow up with Dr. DeMartini, because he's just a wealth of knowledge. That's all I've got to say, a wealth of knowledge. Well, a lot of people do not like to be challenged. Yet, we also know that there is value in challenge. Because I know for me, I've faced a lot of challenges and it has actually benefited me in the long run. How do you handle challenges or struggles?
Well, there's certain laws that govern it. So if everybody writes this down in their head while I'm saying this, maximum growth and development occurs at the border of support and challenge. Maximum fitness occurs at the border of support and challenge. Imagine support being prey and matter challenge being predator, because that's how our brain perceives it. Our amygdala perceives it that way. Our desire center wants to seek prey and avoid predator. So one's support and anabolic and builds our body, food, and the other one eats us and destroys our body and kills us. So we automatically have it. We think, well, I would love to get rid of that predator and only have prey. But what's been shown in the food chain, biological food chain, is if we had prey without predator, we'd be gluttonous, overweight, have all kind of illnesses, and wouldn't be fit and would not be fulfilled mentally. We'd be fulfilled physically, but not mentally. And if we had nothing but predator and no prey, we'd emaciate and starve and we'd be eaten. So the actual maximum fitness is when you've got a predator there, a challenge, and you've got prey there, and you eat just enough to maximally perform, but not too much where you're sluggish and a lot of calories where you get targeted by the predator. So you make sure you eat just enough to maximize your fitness And that's why support and challenge together maximizes fitness, maximizes productivity. And that's why if you don't fill your day with challenges that inspire you, your day is going to fill up with challenges that don't. Just like if you don't fill your day with high priority actions that inspire you, that are meaningful, your day fills up with low priority distractions that don't. So it's not something to avoid, it's something to seek and to go after challenges that are deeply meaningful and inspire you. When a young boy finishes his video games, and he conquers it, and he goes, okay, boring, what does he do? He wants to go to the next most challenging game. Because when you're doing something you really love that's high on your values, you pursue challenges that inspire you. I'm constantly looking for the biggest challenges in human behavior, and how do I find a solution for it? But when you're not inspired by something, not living by your highest values, and filling your day with challenges that you want to solve, and which means helping humanity, solving problems in humanity, you're going to keep attracting challenges you don't want, just to get you to realize that you're off priority and it's time to go back to priority. And that's serving people by doing something to tie in your values.
So you need both. I just love how you combine the word inspire and challenge in the same sentence.
They're the same. Well, yeah. If you look at it, when they did an interview on Phelps, 28 medals, you know, mm-hmm. His coach was there. And he was talking about what he does is he envisions the swim and he envisions every obstacle and he runs every one of them in his mind. And he then rehearses, what will I do if this happens? What will I do if this happens? What will I do if this happens? He says, if I don't do that, I'm unprepared. I can't compete. So I have to go, well, what happens if I've got a swimmer right next to me and their arms come out of the water at the same time mine does and it splashes differently than if their water is coming out, my hand is going down and theirs is going up. It's two different waves sitting in the water and in momentum. So he has to think of the physics of that and think of every possible thing they might be doing on either side of them and calculate what do I do in those cases, the physics of that, and think of those challenges to compete. So he's constantly thinking of it. And the same thing for Elon Musk if he's going to go to Mars. He's not going to go, well, let's go on a positive journey and positive thinking only. You know, he's got to think of every possible thing that might go off. When they just put the Perseverance there on Mars the other day, they had to think of every possible thing that could go wrong and then some. And then they had to prepare for that. So it's embracing challenge in the pursuit of a great cause that inspires you, that leads to greatness.
I love that. Well, I have to ask you this question, though. Share with us a time where your dream first came true. And you experienced that whole thing of like, this is where I'm supposed to be in life.
Okay, so I come back from Hawaii. I take my GED. I guessed and passed. I'm trying now to go and to try to go to school. And I failed my first test. I got a 27. And I needed a 72 to pass. Everybody was above 72. Mine was down at 27. I was really devastated. And my mom, when I got home, I cried, just sitting on the floor crying. My mom caught me there and she said, what happened, son? I told her I blew the test. I bombed it. I guess I'll never be able to read or write or communicate or never mount thing, never go very far in life, because that's what I was told in first grade. And I never did read because of that. And she said, son, whether you become a great teacher and travel the world like you dream, whether you go back and ride big waves in Hawaii or you return to the streets as a panhandling bum, which you've done, I just want to let you know that your father and I are going to love you no matter what. And that put my hand to a fist. I looked up and I said to myself, I'm going to master this thing called reading. I'm going to master this thing called studying, master this thing called learning and teaching. And I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to travel whatever distance and pay whatever price to give my service of love across this planet. I'm not going to let anything or anybody on this planet stop me. I hugged my mom. I went in my room and I got my dictionary. And that's when I started memorizing the dictionary. And all of a sudden, as my vocabulary is growing, I'm now sitting at this little Wharton library and doing yoga. I'm taking a break from reading and I'm doing some yoga stretching. And this 375-pound Afro-American woman came up to me. And she says, my, oh my, can you teach me how to do that? And I looked up, and it's sort of humorous, but that was the first student I ever had that asked me to try to share something with them. And so that was an amazing moment in my life that somebody actually asked me to share something I knew with somebody else. And all I was doing is looking at a book and trying to do postures and yoga to stretch my body to try to keep it limber. And she wanted me to teach her that. And that was the first time I got to be a teacher.
And not your last time.
No.
And praise the Lord for that, because you are truly an extraordinaire and incredible. Well, moving a little bit fast forward here, how can we change what we don't like?
In ourselves or somebody else?
I would stick with ourselves, what we can control.
Well, we have control over perceptions, decisions, and actions. Nothing else. And our hierarchy of values dictates what we're going to perceive, what we're going to do, and what we're going to act on. So I would rather look at, am I expecting from myself something that's matching my real values? I'll give an example. I was standing in South Africa in Johannesburg, and I was doing a presentation with Richard Branson. And there's about 5,000 people. And I asked, how many of you would love to be financially independent? And every hand went up. Some had two hands up, and some had their feet up. I think some had their ears up. And I said, okay, great. And then I said, now, how many of you are financially independent? And all the hands went down, except 7 out of 5,000 people. Because I defined it as a passive income exceeding active income, where you're working because you love to, not because you have to. And I said, isn't it interesting that 99.99% of the population in this room put their hands up, but less than 1% actually has obtained it? And I said that the odds are not in everybody's favor in this room. So I'd like to share something. I said, anytime you expect yourself to do something that's not highest on your value, you're going to beat yourself up, because you're going to procrastinate, hesitate, and frustrate in your actions, because you're only disciplined, reliable, and focused in your highest values. Anytime you do things high in your values, your self-worth goes up. Anytime you do things low in your values, your self-worth goes down. So if you're expecting to be financially independent, but you don't have the hierarchy of values that will lead you to that outcome, you're going to beat yourself up. And I said, how many of you beat yourself up about your financial situation? All the hands went back up. I said, if you have a higher value on buying immediate gratifying consumables that depreciate in value when you buy them, and you don't have a higher value on buying assets that appreciate in value, you're going to work for money all your life as a slave and never have money work for you as its master. I said, so you have to make a decision. Are you going to pursue the fantasy of being financially independent without the values that it takes? Or are you going to calm that down and set goals that are really aligned with your values? Or are you going to change your values to match that goal? I can teach you both those today. Which would you prefer?
Wow. That's incredible. Well, I just know that, you know, values, when we begin to look at ourselves and who we are, that reflection is so important. Our presence, who we show up as, and who we show up as are those values. You've already listed yours out. How can we begin, just as a little tidbit, for those who are interested and they want to like jump on it today, how can we begin to figure out what is our highest value?
Well, it takes some honest inspection. On my website, drdmartini.com, there is a complimentary value determination questionnaire. It takes about 30 minutes. It's 13 questions. And it's only as valid as the answers you put on there, if they're valid. If you lie to yourself, then you're not going to get anything but a lie back. It's going to be a reflection of you. But it's 13 questions to help you bypass the social idealisms that you think you're supposed to be, and to get down what your life actually demonstrates, because your life demonstrates your values. You know, my life demonstrates what I value. It's very obvious. And so whatever is highest on your value is what you're going to keep doing. You're going to find a way of doing it. And if you can delegate all lower priority things, you can have an inspired life. So what I do is I tell people, look at your space. You know, a baby in a baby pen, if you throw something in there and the baby wants it, it'll look at it, it'll put it in its mouth, it'll hold it, it'll keep it there. You take it away, it'll cry. If you throw in there something it doesn't want, it'll kick it out, push it away, throw it at you, scream until you take it out. Even babies have value systems. They already have them. And so you can watch what they fill their space with, and it'll tell you. If you look in my place, when I was in my 20s, put books everywhere. books everywhere. Today it's computer for online learning, but still learning. So my tool that I have in front of me, right in my space, is my gateway into learning and my gateway into sharing and teaching. So the most important thing I have is a computer. So if you look at what you fill your space with in your intimate foot and a half space and in your 4 foot personal space, and what's the three most dominant items there, it tells you what you value, because you keep it where you have access to it, within reach. Then you look at how you spend your time. You make time, find time, spend time on things that are valuable to you, and don't have time and run out of time for things that don't. And so even if you're working and you go, well, I'm having to put 12 hours a day in there, then you have time for financial security. That's what you're doing there. You may not like the job, but you don't see an alternative way of getting that same income for the amount of work you're doing. So you're using that. So what you're really doing is working for financial security. So I look at how you spend your time. And by the way, the same answers will surface if you're honest. There'll be a nice, obvious pattern that's showing. The third one is what energizes you. When you're doing something that's high in your value, your energy goes up. And when your energy goes down, when you're feeling doing something that's, well, I hate doing this, it's drained. It's either gained or drained. The fourth one is money. You find money, make money, spend money on things that are valuable to you. And you don't for things that aren't. I have a value on wealth building. So I invest in assets every week. Not everybody does. Some people buy consumables. I know people that will spend thousands of dollars on food or $1,000 on clothes. And there's no right and wrong on there, because thank God that helps the economy. But if they're expecting to be financially independent, but they have a higher value on buying Jimmy Choo shoes all day long, then they're not likely to do anything except ground themselves with a big closet full of Jimmy Choo shoes. Now, if they could resell those, that might be a different story. But buying assets goes up in value. So then you have to look at what you spend your money on. The fifth one is, what is it you're organized in? Because wherever you have the greatest degree of order and organization is because you value that. My knowledge is organized. All my research, I know exactly where to get everything I need to do. You ask me a question, I know how to get to it. My information is organized when I present it. My travel, when I was traveling, I've traveled 20 million miles traveling. But when I traveled, I had it organized. I had everybody, it's all delegated, it's all structured. I know exactly, people pick me up, it's done all structured. Whatever you value, you bring order to. And the next one is discipline. You're spontaneously inspired and disciplined to do what's really valuable to you. You don't need external motivation, no extrinsic drive, no reminding, no incentives for something really valuable to you. I bet nobody has to tell you to take care of your kids and be with your kids if you love that. And probably doing this podcast and inspiring people or whatever is probably a spontaneity. You just love doing it. But there's some things you go, nope.
Laundry, no.
Laundry, okay, but why do desperate things? Right. I haven't cooked since I was 24. I'm going on 67. I haven't cooked since I was 24. And I haven't driven a car in over 30 years, not driven a car. Because I learned that anything that's not the highest values in my life, top three or four, the ABCs, all the XYZs, I delegate to specialists who love doing that. So I can be around people who are doing what they love, specialists, and do what I love in the process. And that's the path of an inspired life. Delegating all lower priority things so you're liberated to do the higher priority things, and then do them in a way that serves other people so you're remunerated back with sustainable fair exchange. And then you have the income and the outcome of an extraordinary life. So identifying the values is crucial. The next one is, what are you thinking about? And the next one is, what are you visualizing? And the next one is, what are you internally dialoguing with yourself about how you would love your life to be, that shows evidence of coming true? You know, if I say that I want to do something, but there's no evidence of it, it's not really important to me. It's a fantasy. But if I say I have a drive to be a teacher, travel the world, I have evidence of that. Or read and write, I have evidence of that. So I look at what I have evidence that I think, visualize, and talk to myself about. And then the next one is, what do I converse with other people about? You know, you get people coming up to you and they'll say, how's your kids? Or how's your investments? Or how's your business? Or how's your health? Or how's your golf game? They want to bring the conversation to what's important to them. So look at what you converse with about most and keep wanting to bring the conversation to, and it tells you what's important to you. You're probably going to bring people, talk about kids, or you're probably going to talk about personal development or whatever you're doing in the podcast. The next one is, what inspires you and brings tears of gratitude? What inspires and chills in the spine? And what's common to the people that really inspire you? That tells you what is invaluable. Great Nobel Prize winners, great thinkers and great philosophers and great achievers and great leaders, great sports people, great celebs. Anybody that's done something extraordinary, I love studying their lives because I want to do something like that. So that's what's valuable to me. And then the next one is, what are the three most consistent goals that you persevere on that show evidence of coming true, that you don't give up on? The ones that you don't give up on, that you stay and you go the mile. And the last one is, what is it you love studying about, reading about, learning about, listening to about, watching on YouTube most? What's the common things you want to bring into your awareness and learn about? And if you answer those 13 questions with three answers each and get 39 answers, and then look at what answers keep repeating themselves and reiterating, same or similar or synonyms, you'll see very clearly that certain things stand out way more than others, and you'll get to know what's hierarchy of your values. And so it's a great exercise, and I encourage people to do it. And it's not about the social idealisms, peace and honesty and integrity and stuff like that. It's what is it you actually live your life dedicated to doing, what you really value.
And I think that's what's really key, Dr. DeMartini, is, and that's what we're missing. We Google what are values in our life, and we come up with, oh, trustworthiness and courage, and that's all great, integrity, but that's not really
that's
what
you're
saying.
That's not what our life demonstrates.
Right,
no.
Exactly.
See, I learned a long time ago, Diogenes, who was around at the time of Socrates to Plato, that era, he lived in a barrel, and he started the Cynic philosophy, which meant dog-like, because he made a lot of comments about how dogs and humans are similar. And he went all over Europe, traveling around trying to find an honest man, and never found one. Because sometimes what we think is honesty is nothing but an opinion. And it's not really the truth. It's just an opinion that we believe are true. And we're addicted to our pride and our own beliefs sometimes, and we can't see objective information sometimes. So he went around to doing that. And even though some people say, I pride myself on being honest, if they have any judgment on another human being, that's an opinion. And in those moments, which is quite voluminous, as you made a comment earlier, we're not really being honest. Because I love the story of Abraham Lincoln. You can see Abe standing up at a major round table gala event as a president. And there's probably 1,000 people through all the tables. And he gets up and they introduce the president of the United States. And he looks across the room and he scans the room and people are waiting for him to speak and it's silent. And then he looks across at this one gentleman and he points to the gentleman and he says, I don't like this gentleman. In fact, I despise this gentleman. That's all he said. And the whole room divided. The ones that supported that man, well, he's a fine gentleman. I don't know this gentleman. How can you think that? And the ones that were subordinating to him automatically, yes, he's a scoundrel. And they immediately looked down on him. And there was people looking up and people looking down, and he divided the room by that one statement. Just divided the room into their polarities and opinions and who they subordinated and who they exaggerated. And then he paused while he watches the whole room divide as a human behavioral experiment. And then he says, and it just goes to show that I don't know this man. For I am certain when I come to truly know him in his totality, I will love this man. And all the opinions and biases were exposed. And that was his point. He was trying to make a point about how easy we are swayed by our biases, by one authority's opinion.
Whoa, good stuff. Well, we could be here literally all night. And I know it's on your high values list, so you will stay up with me if we could do that. We could be here another 3 or 4 hours if your schedule allowed it. But I want to respect your time. So I know we're going to make sure that we have all the information in the show notes. But where can people find you and connect with you?
Well, if they want to go online, probably just drdmartini.com. drdmartini.com. They could go on to my podcast or my YouTubes or media or whatever there is, because there's thousands and thousands of interviews and stuff on there. And they can go to the value determinant, determine your values. I hope that they'll do that, because it's free, it's private, it's complimentary, and it's meaningful. A lot of companies use it to filter people when they're hiring. Because tell me what your values are and I'll tell you what you're committed to. Because when you hire people, if you don't have a way of filtering them out, they can put some BS on the table. But this way you get right to the core and you find out what they're really committed to. But if they do that, just drdmartini.com. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. Because I'm around out there. I'm constantly doing, you'll find me somewhere out there if you look. I think I'm about 12 million places on the internet, so you can find me.
Well, and I'm sure you will get your traveling legs back moving again here soon as everything begins to settle down and things get to be more of a norm. But before I let you go, I have one final question. This series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
Well, I think the story of me having speaking problems, going to a speech pathologist as a child, learning problems, and I had an arm and leg deformity also, which I think the very voids in your life become your values. And anything you can't say thank you for is baggage. Anything you can say thank you for is fuel. And so my story, the gift of my story is the very things that became my setbacks became the very things that I get to do today. So I'm very grateful for all those challenges, because they're the things that are most meaningful and inspiring today. And I think that we all can find that if we look carefully.
Amen. Most definitely. Well, Dr. DeMartini, it has been an honor and a privilege to have you here. Many blessings on your travels still yet to come.
Yes. Thank you for the great interview and the lovely questions.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.